And how does it feel being the attention of all of this media focus?
In the short run, it feels wonderful.
You haven't seen the article yet.
No.
Is what you're saying.
Yeah. No, it's exhausting. It's physically, psychologically exhausting. I hadn't realized this. I was telling Mitsu that he photographed me in every conceivable situation yesterday, interviews, getting in and out of the limo, in restaurants. And I wrote feature stories for magazines and had a photographer with me, and I had no idea what the subject, what the object was prey to. It's awful. It's exhausting.
And you know they're going to use one photograph. Yes. Well, it's a shot of you and your childhood.
Yeah, that's right. On a bearskin, on a bearskin rug. I've got the shot. Reading a book at the age of 9.
Are you actually on a tour?
Yes.
I mean, a full-fledged media tour?
A full-fledged media blitz, we like to call it.
I wonder what that would be like, Jane.
that's the point.
That's kind of an inside joke. I had written a book in the late 80s, and Jane was my publicist from St. Martin's Press.
What was your book about?
I don't remember. It's been so long ago.
I wanted to do. What was it about? Seriously.
Oh, it was a mystery. It centered around H.L. Mencken. Not necessarily unlike The Queen of Desire, because there again, real and fictional characters were brought into play.
Are you from Baltimore? Is that?
No, I'm not from Baltimore, but I did happen to work in Baltimore for the CBS television affiliate a number of years ago, so I got to know the place.
And Mencken. Well, had you always loved Mencken?
I had always liked Mencken, yes. It was just coincidental.
What, as a stylist? Or?
As a stylist, as a critic.
Do you now or have you ever read A.J. Liebling? Is he?
No, I really don't know very much about Liebling.
Yeah.
Are you a Liebling fan?
He's as good as Mencken stylistically. He's marvelous. No one reads him. He's overlooked.
Yeah, I know, but he has a marvelous reputation. But tell me a little bit, before we go on to The Queen of Desire, tell me a little bit about yourself. I was reading some of the publicity material about you, and it looks like you are living a very colorful life, at least these days.
Yeah, I hadn't realized that until someone called it to my attention that I've done interesting and remarkable things.
But you set out to be an athlete.
And
you're not the first one to do that. Many
I thought
people,
I was. I thought.
Well, no, many people discovered books while in the Navy and on shipboard, for example, and in the Army.
Yeah.
And indeed a good place to retreat to find yourself in some respects.
Did you? I mean, it sounds as though you...
No, but I've talked to a number of people who have done exactly what you said you've done.
This is news to me. No one had told me that. I'm sure it's true. And then through books, I started to educate myself and went to, on the GI Bill, went to Hofstra University.
Just to go back to the books that influenced you, I would guess if you were in the base library, you kind of took pot luck. There was no particular agenda in terms of your reading.
Melville and Hawthorne, just sort of on my own, and then the Russians. I became somehow War and Peace didn't daunt me. Tolstoy didn't daunt me. And it wasn't a literary approach. It was a kind of self-education, a sentimental journey back to what I should have been probably doing if my parents had had their way. But somehow, by finding it on my own, everything stuck. Everything I read stuck in a way that it doesn't stick in school. So naturally, I became a college professor.
And you gave up the idea of joining the Knicks?
My perspective, my understanding, and I guess certain philosophical premises about what life was about changed, and somehow basketball was no longer the center of my existence as it had been in the old neighborhood. These are kind of ritual, cultural, anthropological things.
You gave up childish things.
Yes, and picked up the things of men and women, put the toys aside. And then taught at Hofstra for 25 years, and came home one on a Thursday night. Things happened to me on Thursdays for some reason. and told my wife that I simply wasn't relating to the students the way I had previously and thought it would be wrong to continue.
You outgrew your students.
Wow. No, values changed in the 80s, I think. I was the first.
Your values or your students' values?
My students' values, I think. I mean, obviously, all things are changing all the time. But I was a first-generation college student, college graduate in my immediate family, even though they were very well-educated people and saw education as the means to success. And then when I started to teach at English literature at Hofstra, what was wonderful was that most of my students were also working class, first generation educated, and there was really great excitement. And during the fiscal crunch in the 80s, the university quite understandably decided that the way to stay in business, maintain their existence, was to become pre-professional, essentially a school for pre-professional training. And when you're teaching literature or the arts, I also had re-educated myself in art history and started to teach art history as well. These things like books, poems, short stories, paintings, sculptures, they became secondary to the students getting on with careers. If there were no practical application for what they were doing, then I had the feeling that what I was doing was irrelevant.
I'm not so sure, though. I'm a product of the 50s. I think we were kind of like that, too.
I remember that.
Although there were fewer diversions. There was no Sony Walkman, for example, and there were three television networks and no cable. And LPs, but no CDs, and on and on and on. So I think perhaps the 50s may have been the last big book generation. I'm not sure. That may be a sweeping generality. Yeah. I'm not sure. Last week I read a wonderful biography of Edgar Allan Poe by Ken Silverman, and I was thinking about some of the poems that Poe wrote, and it occurred to me that when I was in high school and junior high school, we had to memorize poems and read them in the class.
Yes.
Here are the sledges with the bells, silver bells, you know, that sort of thing. And I wondered, when did you stop teaching?
85.
Are students still learning to emote poetry like that, the way we used to in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s?
No. The worst answer you can give on a talk show, the answer is just simply no, they're not. And I remember, this is really a sentimental journey, but I do remember my father had a candy store, and we had to memorize whole passages out of Shakespeare. And we would stand behind the soda fountain, and I would talk about the quality of mercy not being strained.
Not quite as good as a topless bar, but still it probably offered something to the customers in the candy store. Yeah, that sprang from an oral tradition that perhaps is irrelevant today. I'm not sure it's necessarily bad that we don't compel students to memorize poetry. And in fact, I have a feeling that many poets were learned to be hated by students who would never read again as a result.
It's interesting. The oral tradition is alive in certain much more alive in certain regions in America and among certain elements of the culture. And I think they produce a very rich kind of novel when they come to expression. The oral tradition in the South is directly related to the way a Southern novel is told. The oral tradition among American blacks is directly related to storytelling. And at its heart, most novels, traditional novels, are wonderful stories well told. It's as simple as that.
And indeed, in reading that biography of Poe I referred to a moment ago, many of the poems that were written in the 19th century were specifically designed to be read aloud. That's what people did after dinner. They went to the parlor, played the piano, and recited poetry.
Well, my daughter's away at college now, but into her mid-teens, I read books to the family by the fireside, and it was good stuff. I liked reading, and they liked listening.
I wonder if that's a decent substitute for Warren Beatty and Dick Tracy, though.
I think it was.
Well, apparently, you began writing, though, while you were teaching in Hofstra.
Yes.
Tell me about some of your early writing. I noticed you have several books to your credit.
Yeah, there's every time, you know, I hope this is an original. So I thought it was original that I learned to educate myself at the Post Library. My father died while I was in the Army. He actually quite dramatically died in my arms, and I had the strong feeling at that moment that I had been a disappointment to him, which I had, there's not a doubt. A few years I got out of the Army honorably, found myself having graduated from college and teaching at Hofstra, and living on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, the strangest things started to happen. I would get up in the middle of the night with reminiscences of my father, particularly in the candy store. And one night, I remember distinctly, I sat down and I wrote this episode of how he used to make malteds. I don't remember the price exactly, but a malted was 5 cents more than a milkshake. And the difference was something called Horlick's malted powder, which was in a canister behind the on the back bar behind the fountain. And there was after the Horlick's malted powder was used up, he never replaced it. And he would charge, let's say, 30 cents for malted, 25 for a milkshake. And the only difference was he would take a spoon, dip into the canister, which was empty, and really actively put nothingness into the malted canister. And one day we were alone in the candy store, and he asked me, did I want a malted? And I said, sure. And there was no difference between a malted and a milkshake. Even for his own son, he went over and dipped into this illusion and made me an illusory malted. And I wrote that story, that memoir, probably over a 2 or 3 night period. Sent it off to the Atlantic. They bought it. Said it sounded like it, as though it were part of a longer work, which of course it wasn't. And I said, yes, it was. And then every night for 2 weeks, I would write another chapter about my father's life. And it became a first book and other excerpts and short stories in the Atlantic. And I thought, my God, this is easy. This writing life is easy. But of course, once you run out of the stuff of life to write about and have to become a novelist or choose to become a novelist, you develop, you realize that there are skills, techniques, understandings that are not quite the same as drawing on dreams and memories.
This past weekend, there was a profile of Robert Stone, the novelist. I've met Robert Stone a couple of times and have always enjoyed talking to him, but he gave the author of this article a revelation that he never told me. When he spent 5 years writing his first novel called A Hall of Mirrors, and then he didn't publish anything again for 10, 12 years. Mm-hmm. And he told the author of the article that he had put the sum total of his entire life into that book. Everything he knew, he put into that book. It took him 5 years.
Yeah.
Every nuance, everything he knew about people, everything he knew about himself, he put everything in there. And when the book came out, he didn't have anything else to say. He had used his entire life to go into that book. And it took years be able to generate new material and new awarenesses and new perceptions.
Well, in my case, it took years to simply learn what I was doing by trial and error. of which Queen of Desire is the culmination thus far.
Yeah, it's amazing. Sometimes you'll read somebody's book and be overwhelmed. At least I am. I'm reading a book now called The Lost Father by Mona Simpson. It's a wonderful book. And it's 500 pages, and it's breathtaking, huge, but it's a masterpiece, giant book. And you say, how did she do it? I couldn't do something like that. How did she do it? Very, very difficult. You wonder about these things, because it does take work, and it takes development to be able to accomplish something like that. It doesn't just happen out of cloth. It is said that everybody has one book in him, although not necessarily the ability to put it down on paper. You understand what I'm saying? The techniques involved, sometimes you envy them and wonder how they do it. Yeah. I would assume this was a process that you had yourself.
Yeah, I didn't know. While I was teaching, I was writing novels and during summers on weekends, during the evening, and telling myself that everything I needed to know to be a successful novelist in my own eyes, as well as hopefully in the world's eyes, would come later. This was going to come later for me. And I don't know whether I really believed that or was simply telling myself that in order to get over the hard part, when I knew that I didn't have at my command the techniques that were necessary, or perhaps even the depth of insight that was necessary, that the rewards and the satisfactions would come later. And to a very great, I mean, I'm very happy about Queen of Desire. I'm very pleased with it. It seems to have justified, this is early in the game to say that, but it seems to have justified the fact that I was promising myself a kind of later success.
Well, let's move into the Queen of Desire. Obviously, Marilyn Monroe is a person that you had become fascinated with over the years. Tell me a little bit about your interest in Monroe.
No, not. I've become fascinated with her while writing, and even more fascinated with Monroe now. I was not a cult follower. In fact, I missed the boat on Marilyn Monroe. I didn't realize when some of the critics started to say, if you remember, she was dismissed early on as a kind of dizzy blonde promoting herself through a kind of comical, tongue-in-cheek attitude towards sex. That was early on, and then a few critics started to say, my God, you know, she has some talent, she can act, she has a comedic gift. I missed that. She didn't particularly interest me as a performer, sexually, in any way. And but Arthur Miller did interest me, and I was reading Arthur Miller's autobiography, Time Bends, in which he described a day in winter when they were living in Connecticut. They were Arthur was married to Marilyn, and Marilyn wanted Frank Lloyd Wright to build a house for them, to design a house. But really what she wanted was to meet an icon. She liked that. And in half a page, Miller describes the day, and no house gets built, and they never meet again. And
Did Frank Lloyd Wright actually go out to Connecticut?
Yes, he went up to Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And that's what triggered my imagination.
You wondered what they talked about while they were there.
Yeah, how did they... where did they stand when they looked at possible sites for a home? You know, what did Wright say? I did know a great deal about, much more about Frank Lloyd Wright and Arthur Miller than I do about Marilyn. And I realized in telling you this that in the same kind of impulse that got me originally to write that short story about my father and his illusory Maltese, I simply started to write dialogue to what they said to each other, and also what they meant and what did they want from each other, etc. And I didn't have a chapter of a novel. I had a kind of fun, interesting short story. And then as Way leads on to Way, I found myself doing it with Marilyn and a couple of other interesting people. Simone Signore, when she was living next door to Marilyn in Hollywood, and a hairdresser, or two famous sports writers at an old-timers' day in Yankee Stadium, sitting in the press box, and what would Marilyn...
That's a wonderful chapter.
Oh, thank you.
Red Barber and...
Who are the great... Red Smith and Jimmy Cannon.
Yeah. Walter Winchell is in the scene.
Yes. And at this point, I clearly didn't have a novel, not a conventional novel. But what I saw happening was the fact that I wasn't a Monroe groupie, or never really drew off from the legend in any way, that somehow she was simply a woman to me, simply a human being. And I began in succeeding chapters to put myself in her point of view and see the world as she must have seen the world. What people don't realize, and perhaps I discovered this doing magazine work and covering celebrities, celebrities and rich people, as Fitzgerald says, are probably different in some ways from you and me. But the last act is always tragic, no matter what role you play in the great drama. And the feelings are always the same. The needs, perhaps exaggerated, but the needs, human needs, tap the same source. And it seemed to me that to reverse the process in which Monroe has always been made larger than life, to take the larger than life character and reduce her to essentially mundane situations would be dramatically and novelistically interesting. And that's what started as a lark became a lark in two chapters, a lark in three chapters. By about the fourth chapter, I became rather serious about what I was trying to do, not trying to eliminate the humor from the book in any way.
You make her naive and shrewd at the same time. Naive, for example, at the old-timers' day at Yankee Stadium, where she wonders about the stripes on DiMaggio's costume, I think is the way she puts it. And very naive about what baseball is. She had never seen a baseball game before. And yet, in a following chapter, where she is in London with Sukarno and Bob Hope in the same room, she knows exactly what's going on with regard to Sukarno and what he's leading up to.
Yeah.
You make her both vulnerable at the same time knowledgeable. I don't know if that's the way she really was, but, I mean, that's the way you have created her.
Yeah. Whether she was or wasn't, I'm not saying it's a moot point, but it's less important than the idea that the Monroe legend has actually told us. I mean, we know that's wrong. I don't know if I'm right, but I know that all that stuff is wrong and is essentially sells books and magazines and stuff at the checkout counter still. And we don't learn anything about her, and certainly we don't learn anything about what it is to be a human being. From those kinds of distortions. The technique I used that I think is interesting is that I really tried not to learn every single thing about her, all of which is contradicted by someone else who's written a book. There are, many hundreds of books about Marilyn Monroe and thousands of articles. What I tried to do to a great extent is look at photographs. I love to look at photographs, even of people I don't know, particularly old family photographs, early 20th century photographs. Look at the eyes, look at the faces, look at the details of the background, of the room, of the house, of the porch, wherever they are. And you delude yourself, but I thought I really started to know the person behind those eyes. And those eyes kept changing. They were shrewd in certain situations, and utterly naive in others. And in some, they were a shrewd person trying to put on naive eyes, and some they were a naive person trying to put on shrewd eyes, etc. So there were multitudes. I'm convinced that, humanly speaking, there were multitudes there. And a very great talent, which I had missed completely, when she was alive. A very great talent. I started to listen to her. She's a terrific singer. I don't know if anyone, you know, even bothers to listen to her anymore. But she's a wonderful singer with great phrasing and a great sense for lyrics.
But she certainly was aware of the things around her. For example, when a camera was produced and began clicking, unlike the two of us who are trying our best to ignore it, she would play to it. And she would flaunt herself for the camera. This I know because I've talked to some people who've taken photographs of her and done picture books, and she would definitely play to the cameras. But it's interesting you tried to imagine what she was like, because that's what Mailer did too. As you know, he wrote a book about Monroe, and he never met her. It was all imagined. Much of it was imagined.
Yeah.
How she really was, what she was really like. I think Kennedy conspiracy enthusiasts will be a little disappointed. The only reference to Kennedy, I believe, is an image of him flickering on a tube.
Yeah. And of Marilyn singing to him at his 45th birthday in Madison Square Garden.
That's right.
But
that's
no,
right.
That, I mean,
but
that's a conscious.
It's not an intimate relationship.
No, that's irrelevant to me. That's for the that's for the world to try to make something of. There's a way in which the big is, the overblown is the enemy. There's a sense in which the overblown is the enemy of the of the pure and the knowable. And I'm bombarded too much with the overblown, with the simplified, with the exaggerated headline, with the clever headline, with the exaggerated images that I see around me. I really want to get to the simple, and the sense that that understanding lies in the details. You know, the way she had her hair colored is very important to me, and what she said, and what she thought about her body, as opposed to what she let the world see about her body. Those are two different things. And the cries for help in her being late, you know, selfishly late all the time. What does that mean psychologically? That if I were working on a movie and being held up and going over budget because Marilyn Monroe was late, sure, I'd be angry with her. But if I were reading about it, I'd want to know what motivates that lateness. You know, is it drugs only? Perhaps. But I think there's another cry there.
Well, Monroe certainly has been much in your mind in the last couple of years. Do you have any theories as to why she was so unhappy? It's never really expressed in Queen of Desire,
no,
for example.
No, there are some, you know, there are some lives that are doomed, many, many too many, by forces beyond anyone's control. So here she is, the bastard child of a mother who's unstable to the point where she's repeatedly put in asylums. She, by her own admission, was abused, sexually abused at a very early age, and taken to live in a series of foster homes. I mean, not much is going to come out of, not much positive is going to come out of that. And one way to deal with a life with those kinds of cards, you know, how you play, if those are the cards that are dealt to you, is to deal yourself a whole imaginary new deck. And so she invents. Marilyn Monroe is an invention.
It's interesting, the men in her life, notably Miller and DiMaggio. I got the impression in reading of Queen of Desire that the marriage fell apart because in some way she was never really theirs. I think you expressed that pretty well with DiMaggio in particular, that there was Marilyn and she was Marilyn, but she was never really DiMaggio. It was Marilyn. Is that, do you think that has some accuracy?
I think given how needy she is and how unfulfilled her desires were, I mean, she may have fulfilled male desires all over the galaxy, but her desires essentially went unfulfilled. There was need in her. I thought she saw, again, just from looking at the photographs and thinking a lot about her, I think she saw in Arthur Miller the kind of Jewish intellectual fatherly figure who would in fact lend her intellectual credibility. In other words, because she was always driven to the self-improvement, reading books that anyone with intellectual credentials recommended, thinking that somehow by osmosis she could become more worthy that way. And with DiMaggio, it was clearly the stern Sicilian. I mean, you have the Jewish Italian. She went one extreme and perhaps the other. Stern, demanding, fatherly, strong-armed figure who would make it all okay for her, who would protect her. And by the way, he did. Joe is very admirable in how, when she fell apart, he strove to protect her from the outside and the dangers. His model is remarkable. One of the memorable figures in American culture in the 20th century, and yet he's unapproachable. He knows exactly how to keep the media and people and demands at bay. And he could have done that for her, but that too is unfulfilling. You can't get someone else's intelligence, and you can't get someone else's sense of distance.
Some of these other episodes, for example, did she really join in that tremendous card game with Gable and Montgomery Clift?
No, that's why Queen of Desire is a novel. I simply imagined, I mean, it was such a bad luck movie, The Misfits, although parts of it, I've seen it again recently, parts of it are marvelous, but it was such a bad luck movie, and The Misfortune, Gable dies shortly after Clift has just come from a horrible car accident. And the marriage is just finished, the Miller marriage, Miller-Marilyn marriage is finished at that point. I just tried to imagine what it would be like to have all these misfits. The movie was really aptly named because they were themselves the misfits. How important luck was in their lives. And I simply used the device of a card game in which Marilyn bluffs them all out of their pants.
Excuse me? Did she ever meet Sukarno?
She met Sukarno once or twice. That didn't come from photos. That came from a little bit of research in which I had read that the CIA knew that Sukarno had an incredible crush on Marilyn Monroe and was somehow going to try to use this for political means. Now, that may have not been at all accurate, but once you read something like that, you're doing a historical novel. You know, you can't let that stay on the table.
Now, your approach to Queen of Desire is using an interview and, I think you call it lights, camera, and action. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the form that you used.
I knew I didn't have a conventional novel in the sense of having themes and motifs interwoven and characters returning and disappearing and returning again. I had two choices. One was to either artificially weave it into a conventional form or simply realize that what I had, if I treated Marilyn's life as a film, what I had essentially were outtakes. You know, that's the stuff that ends up on the cutting room floor that the public never gets to see. These were episodes that would not be and have not been in the film. The popular film of Marilyn Monroe's life. Since I had the outtakes, and since they were kind of cinematographic, I said, well, why not use a real cinema approach and set the scene with lights, tell who what the theme of the scene would be and who the players were by action, and then just let the cameras roll, and that became camera.
Well, I think there's some movement on the part of the people in the room to leave, so I guess it's about time for us to wrap things up. Okay. Queen of Desire gives us a lot to think about, and about a person who indeed herself has been an icon of both beauty and mystery, I guess, to a certain degree. She seems so so real in some respects, and yet so mysterious and so untouchable that I think a lot of people have thought a lot about Marilyn Monroe. And what were, just last question, I guess. If she were still alive, she would be, I guess...
66.
66. What do you suppose she would be like today?
This is probably a terrible thing to say, but there are some people who, when they commit suicide, know exactly what they're doing. And I think in Marilyn's case, that's true. I mean, it does become unbearable. Life can be unbearable for certain people, and suicide is a legitimate option. When I think of Marilyn, and this is not a roundabout answer, but when I think about Marilyn at 66, either fighting weight problems or having let herself go a la Shelley Winters or whatever, on the talk show circuit at night on television, I think the consummation she chose was one that was devoutly to be wished.
She was not the type of person to go gracefully into that gentle, dark night.
No.
Queen of Desire, wonderful book by Sam Toporoff. Thank you very much.